Chapters 10 through 12 are to be seen as a unit. They are the last vision that Daniel has, and he gives of it during the reign of Cyrus. And chapter 10 somewhat serves as an introduction. It's the angel as it appears to him, and you may remember the impact that this angel's appearance had on Daniel. Throughout the course of this chapter, we've seen Daniel weakened and fainting, and this angel reaches out and touches him and strengthens him all of these times. Because as this angel appears to him, he's going to get to the vision itself in chapter 11, which we're going to spend a good bit talking about this morning. But his appearance, his very appearance, seems to cause Daniel to feel faint. And so throughout the course, he strengthens him. And it really says a lot about Daniel as this angel addresses him in verse 19, "O man of high esteem." Now you go back to chapter 10, I believe it is, and he reminds Daniel, you know, "You're beloved of the Lord." It's obviously Daniel's faith was maintained throughout his entire life. As you look at how he's addressed by the messengers of God throughout this book, he's a man that's beloved by the Lord because of his strong faith and his persistent example. And it's a man that's highly esteemed even among those of heaven. Now that's saying a lot about an earthly man, but yet it speaks of the potential that we can have if we demonstrate the same faith Daniel did through his life. So he reaches out, he touches Daniel, "Peace be to you, take courage." And he strengthens Daniel so that Daniel is kind of able to speak to him a little bit, and they're able to have this conversation. It's important for Daniel to be aware and strengthened, and that his mental faculties are really there and in place, so that whenever this vision, as it's delivered to Daniel, and the meaning of it's described in chapter 11, remember, you go back in earlier chapter 10, Daniel says, "I had understanding of this vision." So the angel wants Daniel there. He wants him present. He wants him aware of what's taking place, because this is a significant vision that is going to be given to him, and a significant prophecy that's going to be recorded. And we see here, as he says, "I'm going to have to go soon after I deliver this vision and make known this mystery to you. I'm going to have to go to fight with the prince of Persia." Now, you may remember previously in the chapter, it was the prince of Persia, the spiritual being, whatever it was, demon, maybe some have postulated it was Satan himself, that withheld this angel from getting to Daniel and delivering this vision and this message. Michael finally goes and he frees this angel so he's able to go and deliver that message. He says, "I've got to go and I've got to return to fight with the prince of Persia." Persia was the nation that was currently in power. But he also says something interesting here. "Behold, the prince of Greece is about to come." Now, these are spiritual beings that we're talking about. This angel says, "I've got to return. I've got to fight. There's nobody that stands between me, nobody that stands for Israel aside from me and aside from Michael, your prince." The very last thing he says in chapter 10. And so he proceeds to come to Daniel, make him aware of the situation, let him know why he was held up. And then, as we're going to just a moment read in chapter 11, reveal to Daniel this last mystery that God wants him to record for Daniel's knowledge and for his people. So, with that said, we want to jump into our text in chapter 11. Chapter 11 is a big reason that the book of Daniel is examined so critically by scholars, especially when you consider the liberal scholars and the atheists and the agnostic. Chapter 11 is very largely in part of why people want to say this book was not written during the life of Daniel, that it claims to be written, but rather it was written some 300 years later. Because as you're going to find out as we read through chapter 11 and kind of look at this overview, what it is, it's simply a historical overview of the next 250 years of the Grecian Empire. So that's pretty much what chapter 11 is going to describe for us. Now, if that was written well before all of these things happened, then that makes this a pretty powerful influence for people that wonder, well, was God really involved with this? And it goes a long way to help us understand God's involvement in delivering this prophecy to Daniel. And it's this chapter right here that largely is a contributor for why so many people want to argue against when the book of Daniel was written. We're going to walk away with some important lessons from this. It provides the history essentially from the reign of the Persians, who Cyrus, you remember, is on the throne, and it was during the reign of Cyrus, the third year, that Daniel receives his final vision. So it's going to cover history from essentially the reign of Cyrus to the reign of the Grecian king Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes that we talked a lot about back in chapter 8. Now, there's some important lessons for us just to walk away with, and we'll just kind of mention these on the surface and then jump into the text. One, we see as history is revealed, for us it's history, but for them it was the future, what was going to come in the days ahead. You see that, you read that, you're a Jew during the days of Daniel, or maybe you're a Jew that comes along during this crisis time amongst your people, and you see that God already foretold this. God had already dictated what it was going to happen. And you're going to see some pretty specific details about some of the things that historically are going to occur. And if you're a person of God and you're going through this great trial of your nation suffering and there's war everywhere and you're deeply concerned about the future of your people, you're reminded when you read that God's in control. God foretold these things happening. So his foreknowledge is a reminder that God's in control. And his foreknowledge of their suffering, it's going to be very terrible when Antiochus the Fourth arrives and begins persecuting God's people. And they're going to be looking around and they're going to be wondering, has God forgotten? But when they read this, they'll know God foretold this, and he reminds them near the conclusion of this text that God's going to raise up this persecutor, God's going to bring this persecutor low. And so they're reminded, this time of persecution is not going to endure, we're not going to be obliterated, God's in control. There's dark days ahead, but there's hope at the end. And I think verse 35 in chapter 11 highlights an important lesson, and we'll talk a little more about this when we get there. But it highlights, I believe, an important lesson as to why these terrible things are happening. Look, the angel, as he's speaking, delivering this message to Daniel, he says, some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and to make them pure until the end time, because it still has to come. About persecution, especially of people of God, and especially religious persecution, as the Jews are going to experience unlike anything they've yet to see throughout their long history. It's a purifying process. It's a refining process. Many of the Jews at this point in time when these things are happening have compromised their faith. They've given in to the progressive thinking of the Greeks, and they've helped build these idols and helped participate in these Olympic Games and all of these various things that the Greeks are trying to impose on God's people. They're going to be dealt with in a manner of speaking. But yet those who are faithful to God's law and those who do stand firm, it's somewhat of a strengthening process. Yes, they're suffering. Yes, they're hurting. But at the same time, they grow more reliant on God. And so God's people are really purified in a sense. And if you look at this, Israel has struggled with idolatry all throughout their history. They've worshipped foreign gods. They've worshipped the Baals. They've worshipped Molech and all of the heathen gods. You get to this point in time where they're persecuted like never before. They're purified. Now, from this point forward in the Jews' history, they don't go back to idols. Now, they hold to some false Jewish precepts that they aren't supposed to have and that they're supposed to relinquish, but they don't go back to idols like they have before. And I think part of that was part of God's plan. These people needed to be purified. They needed to be woken up spiritually. They needed to realize there's nowhere else for us to go. And after this great persecution, the Jews really walk, regarding idolatry, they walk the straight and narrow. They don't turn and veer off after these foreign gods. And I think part of that is why God calls them to suffer this great affliction at the hand of this tyrant. But more on that as we get there later. Ultimately, the purpose of what God is doing is to pave the way for Christ. John the Baptist would come and he would prepare the people, but in a sense, the people had already been prepared because they'd been purified spiritually to turn away from idols and to look for the Messiah. And Jesus is going to come probably some 300 years after a lot of these events take place. God, I believe, is preparing the people through purification, through trials, for Jesus who is to come, because ultimately that's what everything's about. That's what this book is ultimately pointing toward, to where true atonement, everlasting forgiveness is brought in to God's people. And we're going to find out historically some of the things that will be taking place as Israel is forewarned of what's going to be coming in the days ahead. Now here's a very kind of brief breakdown of the chapter itself. Verses 1 and 2 just give a very brief history about the kings of Persia that are going to come. Verses 3 and 4 talk about Alexander the Great. Remember the end of chapter 10? That angel said the prince of Greece is about to arise. Well, Greece is about to become a major player on the world stage of history. And that's going to really take off with Philip of Macedon, who's the father of Alexander the Great. and Alexander himself, who is referred to in verses 3 and 4 of Daniel 11. Chapter 11, 5 through 19 is going to address various events that occur in what's known as the Syrian Wars. And we're going to talk about that in a little greater detail when we get there. We'll just summarize the Syrian Wars. And it's really, chapter 11 itself is building toward the arrival of this evil tyrant that's going to be coming, who we've looked at quite in depth in chapter 8, so we'll be able to move through that last portion of text pretty good haste. Antiochus Epiphanes, who's going to be a persecutor of the Jews. So the purpose of this particular vision is to remind, to let God's people know, this is what's coming around the bend. It's going to be terrible, it's going to be awful, but God is in control. So with that said, let's look at the first four verses of Daniel chapter 11. Brother Barker, would you read that for us, please?
Also in the first year of Darius the king, Darius the Medes, Persian, and I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the poor shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of the Greeks, up against the realm of the Greeks. And then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his prosperity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides thee.
Okay. You know, we're really at a disadvantage to truly appreciate a large portion of what Daniel is going to be revealing from this angel. We're looking at it from hindsight. We're looking back at it. It's already happened. And so as we see the detail of historically what's going to occur with the Jews and the Greeks and the Egyptians, we can say, you know, that's prophecy being fulfilled. But imagine reading these things and seeing them to transpire as you were alive. It'd be like someone speaking and talking about what's going to happen with the United States in the next 50 years, the types of leaders that we're going to have arise, and the skirmishes that we as a nation are going to be involved with, and some of the goings-on with our relationship with other nations, and how that may fail or how that may be strengthened. Imagine that was the perspective you're reading it from, because that's really a large value of what Daniel is offering here. He's offering foresight, foreknowledge to these people who are living through these challenging times. And as we look back at it, we really can't have the same appreciation they did, but do try to consider. They're going through these things. They're experiencing these things. They're witnessing Daniel, who has foretold these things hundreds of years before they've occurred, and their faith is being strengthened in that. So bear that in mind as we consider some of the things that we read about here in this text. We see in the first verse that this angel arose to be an encouragement and a protector to Darius. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar strengthened the Babylonian Empire, and it ends up in the hands of this feeble excuse of a king who we read about in Daniel 5 named Belshazzar. And that's really where the Babylonian kingdom begins to crumble. This angel says, I arose and I strengthened Darius the Mede. Now, you'll remember Darius was the one that invaded Babylon. He took the city, and he killed Belshazzar, who was the current king. This process of this angel strengthening him, we don't know how that necessarily was done. What we do know is that Darius the Mede set out to capture Babylon, the greatest nation, the greatest army in all of the world at this point in time. When he goes in, you look at history. Yes, the king dies, but Babylon was taken by Darius the Mede with relatively little bloodshed. There was no big war. There was no thousands of troops dying in defense of the city of Babylon. He marches in. He takes Babylon with essentially minimal loss. And that makes sense. This angel says, I arose, I strengthened Darius the Mede in the first year of his reign when he took the city of Babylon. He took it with little resistance while the Babylonians were celebrating their defense and their greatness. He took the city amidst that and didn't have to wage war. He didn't have to shed blood to take the city. In verse 2, this angel says, three more kings are going to arise. Now remember, you go back to chapter 10 and verse 1 as Daniel receives this last vision. It's during the third year of the king of Cyrus, of the Medes and the Persian. Cyrus is currently the king of Persia. Verse 2 says, three kings are going to arise. Cambyses, the second, which is actually Cyrus's oldest son, and he's going to reign a few years. And then this imposter is going to come up, and he's going to take the throne. Galmata, he's going to take the throne for a year, being an imposter, acting as King Cyrus's youngest son, as if he were to have a legitimate claim to the throne, which he doesn't. So this third king is going to arise, Darius the third. He's the cousin of Cyrus, and he kills this imposter. Those were the events that were going to take place. Those were the three kings that were going to arise. Now what Daniel's really pointing toward, or this angel I should say, is pointing toward at the end of verse 2, three kings are going to arise, but a fourth is going to come. He's going to gain far more riches than all of them. That is, his predecessors. He's going to become more wealthy than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong enough through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. So the fourth king that we read about there is Xerxes. That's another name we've heard before. Where do we know Xerxes from? Also known as Ahasuerus to us. Okay, Book of Esther. So when we go read about Esther, it takes place during the reign of Xerxes. He's the fourth Ahasuerus. He's the fourth king that comes up in the Medo-Persian Empire, that becomes great, becomes wealthy, and is going to arouse his kingdom and then attack Greece. He'll arouse the empire against Greece. What Darius III had attempted to do previously was he attempted to conquer the city of Athens back around 490 B.C. in what's called the Battle of Marathon. Now, just to give everybody a heads up, Daniel 11 is going to be a major dosage of history. The good news is there's not going to be any questions. There's not going to be a test. But it is going to be a big dose of history. That's largely in part what the text is. And the only way to avoid it, but we're going to try to move through it, hit the high points, and not dwell too long on some of the more detailed information. We just want to kind of gather the highlights of the history of what's taking place and what it's ultimately pointing toward. But Darius III, Xerxes' predecessor, made an attempt to take the city of Athens, which was the capital of the Grecian Empire. And when he marched on Athens, it was with an army of over some 1 million men, and all of his nations that were subservient were supplying for this military entourage. Some had given foot soldiers, some had given horses, some had given materials to build battleships, some were providing food. All of the nations subservient to the Persians were supplying what was needed for this war against Greece. Now you may remember the Battle of Thermopylae. That's one of the preludes to this great battle where he tries to take the city of Athens, the capital of Greece. In the Battle of Thermopylae, he lost, it's believed, some 20,000 of his best soldiers, and he's humiliated there in that defeat. However, he does turn things around. He goes inland, and he ends up subduing most of Greece. And he ends up making this retreat, finally reducing Athens to ashes. Finally, some 10 years later, after he's trotted on most of Greek, he once again goes to war. However, he's subdued by the Grecian navy, essentially. So he leaves a small force, small being 100,000 men, which was a smaller portion of his major army. He leaves 100,000 men by the United Greece force, and he goes back to Asia, leaving those 100,000 men there. And so, once again, what Greece realizes they've got to do, Greece is a nation, if they want to withstand this attack by the Medes and the Persians, what they've got to do is they've got to stand united. And so they unite their entire military, and they go to war with Darius III of the Medes and the Persians. And what they realize is they defeat the army that he's left there. They defeat those 100,000 troops, and what they realize is the enormous potential that exists for them as a nation when they stand divided. Now, what you're going to see about Greece, they're not good at standing united. Rather, they tend to divide. They tend to weaken themselves through individual, local people that are yearning for power. And as a whole, the empire is weakened. We're going to see that after Alexander the Great dies. But this is the nation of Greece that Alexander and his father Philip were born into. They were born into a Greek empire that begun to realize how powerful they would be if they but united. And that's what Alexander the Great was going to really successfully do. He was going to unite all of Greece, and he was going to unite their military forces, and he was going to do some great things. So that's the kind of Greek nation that Alexander and his father were born under when they begin to realize the potential that they had. Anyway, more significantly, this is a fulfillment of what it's said in verse 2, where this fourth king was going to gather these riches. He was going to arouse the entire kingdom of the Medes and the Persians against Greece. Now, Darius failed in his attempt. And so what his successor, King Xerxes, was going to do was essentially try to make the same attempt on the empire of Greece that Darius the Third had done. He would arouse the entire empire against Greece. Now, in verse 3, we kind of have some time transpiring here. We've transitioned from the defeat of the Medo-Persians. He would be unsuccessful in that endeavor. And the Grecians really take center stage now as the most powerful nation in the world. Verse 3, a mighty king will arise. He will rule with great authority, and he'll do as he pleases. This is referring to, as we looked at once again, in I believe it's chapter 8, Alexander the Great. He was going to arise as a young man. He was going to unite the armies of the Greeks. He was going to overthrow the might of the Persians. He was the one that had his way with the nations. And he was going to conquer much of the known world as it pertained to the Jews and God's people. He was going to take control of that in just 10 short years, unseating Persia as the ruling power and expanding Greece's empire. Now, verse 4 reminds us, though, who's really in control here. As soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass. So you've got Alexander the Great, who, you look at him historically, he would have been a guy to use the modern language in describing Alexander the Great. He was a beast. That's the term you use to describe a man that had the limitless potential to just destroy and have his way with the world. He was that person. And history, no doubt the nations then, had to just simply tremble at his name. When you consider what he had done in 10 short years, revolutionizing war and the fighting style that the Greeks used, that phalanx that they used to capture many of their enemies and really expand their empire in that short time. He's up and coming, and you can't help but wonder, this guy's 30 years old. He's conquered so much of the world. Now what's he going to do next? But we're reminded here in verse 4, God is in control. You go back, and a lesson Nebuchadnezzar learned the hard way was that God reigns in the kingdoms of men. God raised up Alexander the Great, and he was a mighty man unlike any conqueror that the world has seen at this point in time. And the things that he was able to do with his military might were just astounding, even by today's standards. But yet this great man, who perhaps had this limitless future ahead of him, as it would seem, is laid low by the God of heaven. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. And we're reminded now who's in control. As soon as he is arisen, verse 4, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass. He died mysteriously at the age of 32. He left behind two sons. One, appropriately, probably, was named Hercules. We think of Hercules, the great Greek hero from the stories, who accomplished all of these things by his great feats of strength. He was assassinated shortly after Alexander's death. His other son, Alexander Agis, was poisoned at the age of 13. Now, once again, this is all happening as Daniel has foretold. You may remember that his kingdom's not going to be given to his own children. Rather, it's going to be given to others who were not from his lineage. So he has these two children who would have taken the throne. They're both young. Both are assassinated. Alexander has no one from his line to carry on and reign as king. And so what takes place, his generals are going to contend for power for the next 45 years or so. Various leaders in his army that were successful for him are going to contend, and the nation of Greece is going to, once again, as it has done so well in its past, is going to divide its power. It is going to be weakened through this division. Now, that's the fulfillment. You go back to chapter 8 and verse 8. You remember the vision of the goat with the horn. He comes, he attacks the ram, he kills the ram, the horn breaks. That's Alexander's death. These four small horns come up in his place. That's the fulfillment of the death of Alexander the Great and the four central generals that would reign and divide the land of Greece. And this is a very important map. You can see there, after all of these wars go on with the generals, as things finally begin to settle down and dominance is established, we know who's in control of the various portions of the Grecian Empire. They've got their foothold there, and things begin to kind of regain consistency. There is the breakdown of how Alexander's great empire was divided. The most significant for us that we'll be paying attention to, the chapter 11 is going to address, are the goings on between these two portions. See that large seaweed looking green color there? That's what's referred to as the Seleucid Empire. And you've got them, they're going to contend quite frequently with this olive color portion of Greece there. That's the Ptolemy dynasty. And what you're going to hear them referred to as throughout the course of chapter 11, if you've read that, you've noticed these terms, the king of the north and the king of the south. Almost any time you talk about the south in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, it's talking about Egypt. King of the south is going to refer to the king of the Ptolemy dynasty or the Ptolemaic dynasty. And the king of the north is going to speak of the king of the Seleucid dynasty. So there was a lot that had taken place after the death of Alexander, and this war goes on. Ptolemy the First was perhaps one of Alexander the greatest, his most able generals. And as soon as Alexander died, he secured for himself what was in his mind the best portion of the empire. That was this portion of Egypt. As you can see, it's defended by water here, the Mediterranean, the Red Sea. Really the only place, if you want to overthrow, if any of the other portions of Greece wanted to attack him, they would have this little bitty inlet there that they would have to come and funnel their armies in through there. And so it was easy to defend. It was very fertile land. And so he took for himself, Ptolemy, one of Alexander's generals, took for that lower portion of the Grecian Empire. And it was going to persist until about 30 AD when it would finally be defeated by Rome and be absorbed into the great Roman Empire. Seleucus was another general of Alexander the Great's, and as you can see, he took the largest portion of Alexander the Great's domain, all of that light green up there. That was what essentially became the Seleucid Empire. Now, there's going to be a lot of strife in between the king of the north and the king of the south. If you know much about geography, particularly geography during the days of God's people, you know where Jerusalem's located. Right there by that ugly little J, that red dot that's right there, that's where Jerusalem's at. And that's why we have essentially the goings-on of what's taking place between the Egyptians, that is the Ptolemies, and the Seleucids. Because Jerusalem is going to be caught right there in the middle of this fighting that's going to take place back and forth between the Seleucid dynasty and the Ptolemy dynasty. And so the war, the battle, the skirmishes, the unrest, all of these things are going to have a significant impact on God's people that are located right there. And you may be wondering, well, why does the Bible talk about the history of the Greeks in such great detail? How is it important to us? Well, it's because of where Jerusalem was located and the impact that these wars between the Greeks would have on their people. So that's the location there of Jerusalem, and that's why we have so much information about these two dynasties in chapter 11. Okay, in 301, Ptolemy, who was one of Alexander's generals, he's going to gain control of all of Syria. And we talk about Syria, just this kind of region here. And for the next 250 years, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, they're going to be battling over that Syrian area. Now, the Ptolemies are going to have it for probably 100 years. At one point in time, as we'll discover later, the Seleucids are going to finally come down. They're going to take that portion of the Ptolemies' land. They're going to be the ones in control of the area of Jerusalem, the greater Syria area. So a lot of what's taking place here is regarding those two people. So let's look very briefly. I know we're almost out of time this morning. Let's look briefly at chapter 11, verses 5 through 10. And we'll read that. I have a little bit to say. We won't be able to get too far in our discussion. but we'll be able to kind of lay some groundwork for where we'll be going next week. Homer, would you read that text for us, please, 5 through 10?
Also the king of the south shall become strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. She shall be given up to those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. But from a branch of her roots one shall rise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. He shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife.
All right, so we're out of time for this morning. We'll pick up next week looking at verses 5 through 10. But as you probably noticed there, there was going to be an attempt at this marital alliance in verses 5 and 6 between the king of Egypt and the king of Syria, the king of the south and the king of the north. So we'll pick up with that marital alliance as Daniel is foretelling these things that are going to happen. So from there, we'll talk a little bit about the Syrian wars. And we're going to just work our way through this text without getting too bogged down on some of the details. So any comments, questions on our study from chapter 11 this morning? Okay, we're going to try to work through this in no more than three lessons.
I know history can be tough to swallow a lot of it. Once
there's a lot of it that's here. But we're going to try to concisely work our way through this in no more than
two or three
lessons. So I thank everyone for their participation in our study this morning. I encourage you to read Daniel 11 a couple of times throughout the course of the week to prepare for our discussion next week as well.
Thank you.